We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
The American Family Association's mission is to inform, equip, and activate individuals to strengthen the moral foundations of our culture. We also support the church. Our goal is to be a leading organization in biblical worldview training for cultural transformation. We believe that our ministry, as well as everything in the heavens and on earth, belongs to God, and our role is that of a trusted manager.
Thank you for standing with the American Family Association.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government.
I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Well, it is Tuesday, November 12th, and we are just a week past the election, and already President-elect Donald Trump is staffing his administration, and there have been a number of appointees, at least according to the news. So he has asked former Green Beret Florida Representative Mike Waltz, not to be confused with Tim Walz, by the way, to be National Security Advisor. Trump has appointed Representative Elise Stefanik of New York to be his UN ambassador. Reports are saying that Marco Rubio, a senator from Florida, will be the pick for Secretary of State. And former ICE Director Tom Homan will be the new border czar. Also, Stephen Miller will be the Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, while Susie Wiles will be his Chief of Staff. So already a lot of people that are going to be staffing this administration. He's really wasting no time. But this would not have happened without a lot of significant work on the ground from America First Policy Institute and America First Works. And the headline coming from Just the News says this: early voting ground game changed the math for Republicans this election cycle. And this is up and down the ticket. So Ashley Hayek is the chief engagement officer for AFPI, and she joins me now. So Ashley, this was a significant win. And as the Kamala Harris campaign is $20 million in the hole, and she spent so much money on sets and influencers and other things, and the Democrats are pointing fingers and playing the blame game, what went well for Republicans this cycle?
Good morning, Jenna. Thank you so much for having me. I remember we spoke maybe about a year ago, kind of talking about right as we were getting into this, and we saw an amazing opportunity to start mobilizing voters early. It was something that was attempted in 2022 and 2023, but unfortunately, most of the tactics ended up cannibalizing our Election Day voters and just moving them to early voters. So we needed to expand the base. We needed to reach out to historically untouched communities that we know that President Trump does really well with his policies and his messaging. And using his plan, using his Agenda 47, we were able to mobilize significant numbers of people. We had a very extensive ground game. We started in 19 counties in 7 battleground states. By the time we were done, we were in about 47 counties. And we had about a 40% conversion rate for early and absentee vote, getting people who did not vote in the 2020 election or maybe vote in every one in every four elections to come out early and vote this election cycle. So it was a very intentional effort. We were able to move. We monitored all of our numbers. We tracked all of the people who we knocked. For example, we knocked about 477,000. We visited 477,000 voters in Arizona, and 47% of those voters ended up voting early. So our margin going into Election Day was already 106,000 voters. And if you recall, the state was lost by only 10,000 votes. So that set us up for success on Election Day when we know those high propensity 4 out of 4 voters were going to show up.
And that's amazing. And that kind of ground game is absolutely clearly what was needed to push those numbers up, especially in the sweep of the swing states. And if you compare that and what actually happened to the polls that suggested that this was going to be such a tight race, is that what the numbers were looking like internally, or were you and America First Policy Institute more confident of a clean sweep that ended up happening on the swing states?
Well, it was really interesting because the media coverage of the election leading up, like the weekend before, appeared to be a lot more spin than fact. If you recall, they were talking about all of the women that were supporting Kamala Harris and how this would be a historic moment for women. She really leaned into race by trying to appeal to more Black voters or Hispanic voters, minority voters. And when we were looking at the numbers, we view this as a big math problem. It was very clear just on the early and absentee ballots that conservatives dramatically closed the gap on absentee and early voting with all of these demographics. So, for example, the weekend going into the election, 217,000 more Republican women voted in 2024 in the battleground states, while 424,000, almost a half million fewer Democrat women had voted compared to the same point in 2020. So the math just wasn't there. And it was very much the left trying to gaslight the American people and the media establishment trying to gaslight the American people once again that she has all of this momentum. That just wasn't there. But Jenna, like, this is a woman who said, what is a woman? This is a woman who, you know, their whole party had called us chest feeders and birthing people, stripped Title IX, forced, you know, allowed men to be in women's bathrooms and locker rooms, invited, you know, transgender, had Transgender Day at the White House on Easter. And then you expect women and families to come to your rescue and vote for you. It was completely out of touch from reality.
Yeah, and Tim Wildman, actually, our listeners will know, our president here at AFA, texted me yesterday saying a quotation from Bill Maher that said, quote, "Harris lost every demographic except illegal immigrant inmates who want sex change operations." I think that's probably accurate.
Exactly right.
And I'm speaking with Ashley Hayek, who's the chief engagement officer for the America First Policy Institute. And the left just leaned into the absolute crazy and the most extreme left of their base. And so as you were going out, you know, making all of these engagements with voters, what were the number one issues that that drove that kind of turnout?
Well, the number one issue that cut across all demographics was the economy, hands down. You know, we saw a dramatic shift after Kamala Harris was the deciding vote on the inflation, so-called Inflation Reduction Act. Orange juice went from $4 to $8. We saw, you know, gas prices explode. One of our walk pieces had exploding groceries on it saying prices are too high. And that just resonated, you know, across every single demographic as people are struggling to make ends meet. The second issue we heard was the border. And we talked to moms in Scottsdale whose children were poisoned from fentanyl. We talked to, you know, girls in colleges who felt unsafe after Lake and Riley. So it was not surprising to us, you know, seeing what we saw, you know, in the communities, that was those two issues were the top two issues. The third issue that came up was education, and that came up a lot in Nevada, but more so in Michigan. When you have a governor like Governor Whitmer, who, you know, forced kids out of school, forced the crazy, you know, indoctrination, woke transgender policies, I was not surprised to see that pop, especially in around September. And one more thing, in Michigan, we actually had a team of about 20 Arabic men and women who also targeted Dearborn specifically. And a lot of that community, they're independent business owners. They don't tolerate the transgender woke in the public schools either. And they said point blank, you know, there was peace under President Trump. We did not have that under Obama, and we certainly don't have that now. You know, we need to have strength in our government again. And those young men, they knocked on thousands of doors and ultimately ended up flipping Dearborn, Michigan, which was pretty phenomenal.
That is incredible. And yes, some of these districts that flipped, I think is a huge, huge wake up call for the left and a total repudiation of their extreme agenda, but also shows that people want Trump policies. They want the America First policies. And so in the 2 years now that Republicans have the trifecta, there's a lot of work to be done. But moving forward, of course, into the midterms, what is America First Policy Institute looking at in terms of the ground game to continue this type of turnout?
So we have a short-term and long-term vision. Our first goal, short-term goal, is going to be the first 100 days of the new administration. We were able to survey about 750,000 people, get that many surveys. We also did over 30 million text messages where we were able to identify what policy issues people care about in these battleground states. And it's really about the relationships. So we've been building relationships with people in the communities for about 2 years now. And the goal is to make sure we can mobilize people to advance the America First policies within the first 100 days. That's going to be the first, big battle that we have. The second piece is making sure our folks get through Senate confirmation, which now should be a lot more attainable given we have a majority in the Senate. And then the third piece of this is looking at that long-term plan on how do we continue to mobilize, especially in the congressional races. That's going to be a huge, opportunity for conservatives at this point. And also taking these policies and pushing them out into the states. One place that we were really successful was in Arizona, where we were able to elevate ballot initiatives like Children Are Not for Sale, which puts automatic life in prison for anyone who's convicted of sex trafficking a child. So taking those great policies, elevating important issues, there's a lot of opportunities to take these policies into the states as well. So I think this is just the beginning of a very, very big movement. We have the data. We've always ceded that to the left. We have the technology. We've ceded that to the left. And now we've built the relationships so we can build on these relationships and make sure that everyone continues to talk about the policies, move the policies forward at all levels of government.
And that's a really important plan, especially for, as you mentioned, taking advantage of some of the states, because what we also saw on the ballot were a lot of these citizens initiatives that the left was pushing with a lot of, Soros funding, Planned Parenthood funding, a lot of these things that not only were, some of them were bad election integrity bills, of course, abortion referendums and so forth. And so when the left is trying to just ignore the regular process of the legislative process, that becomes an important factor as well. And so in terms of just education, I mean, here in my home state of Florida, I really think that Amendment 4 only failed because Governor DeSantis was out educating voters on exactly what this was going to end up doing, not just saying, well, this is pro-choice versus pro-life. Even pro-choice voters ultimately rejected it. But when we look at the stats, it's only because of that 60% threshold. So in terms of just those types of initiatives as well, is that also something that you're looking at?
Absolutely. And it was something we got involved with a little bit in this cycle. Again, that Children Are Not for Sale. There was the banning ranked choice voting in Nevada and some other opportunities that we saw. Michigan was interesting. They had a city charter amendment, and it was in the city of Saginaw, and it was for Back the Blue. We ended up hosting a town hall with former NFL player Frank Murphy to talk about crime in communities. It was really funny. The day of the event, I got a phone call from a community member asking if we would go and meet with the mayor. Saginaw has a Democrat mayor, all Democrat city council. We show up to the meeting. The police chief is there. The sheriff is there. There's all these, the council members are there. And they start asking, like, what is this city charter amendment? What is happening? And our goal was ultimately to raise awareness to crime and give citizens an opportunity to voice their opinion and say, we need to address this in our city. Saginaw flipped red. And I do think a lot of that had to do with the Back the Blue city charter amendment. And so that gave power to the people to demand from their leadership, we need change in our city. And so I think you're going to see a lot more of that moving forward.
That's amazing. And Ashley Hayek, in just the last minute we have with you, if people who are listening want to engage in this and they want to be part of the ground game, they want to turn out for these important issues and the values, of course, that we all champion as conservatives, how can they connect with AFPI and America First Works?
Two simple ways. You can go to AmericaFirstWorks.com, all spelled out, and sign up. There's so many opportunities to get involved and volunteer. And the second is you can text VOTE to 85152, and we can get back to you on different opportunities there as well.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to connecting with you again as we continue to move forward and seeing all of, hopefully, the policies that are going to work for America and getting our country back on track. So, Ashley Hayek, thank you so much for all of the work that you and the America First Policy Institute are doing. And we appreciate that you are championing these values and just really educating voters on the worldview differences between the policies of the left and the right. Because ultimately, I think that when people actually look at it, it's not just a matter of who's at the top of the ticket or who's running. It ultimately matters what they want for themselves and their families, and they're choosing the best path, and that's what's so important. So thank you again, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as President-elect Donald Trump continues to staff up his next administration, there is a lot to discuss about Robert F. Kennedy's role, Jr.'s role in all of this with MAHA, or Make America Healthy Again. And it's interesting to see how, a lot of voters and in some of these exit polls and, what we're starting to learn about the composition of everything that happened in the election, a lot of voters were very excited for not just Trump, but everyone around him and that whole team, of course, bringing in RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard, former Democrat. Also, how much Elon Musk pushed on social media and is going to be the head of whatever ends up being a DOGE or the Department of Government Accountability and all of those things, or efficiency, I think it is. Not DAGA, it's DOGE. But anyway, so all of these things are actually really exciting and a lot of policy that will be ultimately good for the country. So here to discuss more on what MAHA could include is our friend who goes by the moniker Raw Egg Nationalist, who is an author and health expert. So Raw Egg, good to have you back. And hey, let's MAHA.
It's wonderful to be back, Jenna. It's actually kind of hard to believe that we've reached this point where we might actually at last see some fundamental movement, some fundamental attempt actually to address the problem of American ill health in a real way.
Yeah, absolutely. And so where should Trump place RFK Jr. in terms of where he could be the most effective and efficient? I mean, should it be the head of just one departmental agency like the FDA, or kind of this, just kind of floating policy person that's empowered to basically bring forth policy ideas on all kinds of issues?
Yeah, well, this is actually a very difficult practical question. So now we've got past the we're still in the euphoria stage, really. I mean, the election was only a week ago, but we're going to have to get down to some serious practical considerations. And there are arguments for and against, I think, both positions. On the one hand, if we're talking about the nature of the problem, then it's very clear that it's a problem that goes beyond the boundaries of any single department in the US government. So this isn't just about the FDA. This isn't just about the EPA. This isn't just about Health and Human Services. This isn't just about the USDA. This is about all of them. All of them need to be reformed. And so on the one hand, yes, you could see that maybe the best thing for Robert F. Kennedy to do would be to be a kind of floating minister without portfolio type of character who can go between all of these different government agencies and intervene and formulate policies, etc., without being tied down. But then on the other hand, of course, you have the problem that if these departments are run individually by other figures, then there is the potential for clashes, for fundamental clashes. If the people who are, you know, who are appointed in these government agencies, the FDA, etc., clash with the kind of Maher agenda of people who don't actually, who aren't actually really on side with what Robert F. Kennedy wants to do. And we've had some early indications that there are certainly people who are lobbying to get, shall we say, people who are sympathetic to Big Pharma in at the FDA. So I know that there's a kind of lobbying attempt at the moment to get Bobby Jindal, the former Louisiana governor, in at the HHS, for example. And I think that appointments like that could be a really big problem for Robert F. Kennedy if he is in this kind of floating position where actually it might leave him isolated and without the necessary kind of grounding in a particular agency organization that will allow him to intervene directly. So we're facing some pretty difficult practical questions, and I'm hoping that we find some kind of pragmatic solution that allows Kennedy to move between agencies, but also directly to intervene in them and actually, you know, kind of enforce the Maher agenda rather than just being there and sort of making suggestions.
Yeah, and actually affect change and the policy that the Trump administration has said that Trump wants. And I'm speaking with Ra Ig Nationalist, who's an author and health expert. And, you know, this was the clash of the first administration and from 2016, when we really all saw on a very wide scale how deep and disgusting the swamp is, you know, meaning all of these things that you're talking about with the career workers in the federal bureaucracy and also the people who want to take ultimately the lobbyist incentives because maybe they're going to go into some of those big pharma jobs after they leave the federal government. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that that people can and have in the past undermined Trump's agenda. And so the practical side of this to ensure that some of these things actually get done, I think that's going to be the biggest question, especially in the first 100 days. Because, like, for example, Trump posted a video, I think it was yesterday, saying that he will close the Federal Department of Education, send it all back to the states, allow local states and counties to decide their education policy. That's great. That's constitutional. That's wonderful. But you know that he's going to get a lot of pushback on that. And so in the short term, like, say, you know, the first 100 days, what would be your top priorities, or it, you know, if you were RFK Jr. advising him, would be the main things to focus on in the immediate term?
I think personnel is the big thing here. I think if they can get rid of people who are going to be obstructive, the worst kind of offenders, the people who are the most corrupt in institutions like the FDA and the EPA, etc., the USDA, then that will set up the rest of the agenda for the next 4 years. So I think that what if I were Bobby Kennedy, I would definitely be pushing for powers to get rid of corrupt bureaucrats, to get rid of people who are compromised, to get rid of the people whose ties to Big Pharma and Big Ag are too intimate, people who are part of this revolving door culture, because they are going to get in the way. Absolutely, they will frustrate and stymie any attempts at reform because they have the backing of these huge, huge industries and enormous amounts, billions and billions of dollars. I mean, that's what this comes down to, really, is the billions and billions of dollars that Big Pharma and Big Ag have invested in the personnel of the regulatory systems that are supposed to be independent of them. So I think it's a personnel problem. And this is a problem, actually, like you say, this is a fundamental problem for Trump. He learned it at great cost during his first administration. I don't think, you know, I mean, he's an outsider. He was an outsider. I don't think he quite appreciated just how deep and how murky the swamp was. and that actually he needed, you know, personnel. That was the real problem. He needed to have people he could trust everywhere, and he didn't. And in fact, people he thought he could trust turned out to be, you know, to betray him in various different ways. I mean, it's very clear that he has learned from his mistakes. You know, he hasn't invited Nikki Haley or Mike Pompeo back into government, for example. I mean, that was a good sign. That was encouraging. He's appointed Tom Homan to be the border czar. I mean, I couldn't think of a better person to do that job than Tom Homan. He is a serious, serious man. So there are encouraging signs. But yes, I mean, it is a fundamental question of personnel. I think that's what needs to be addressed first.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I've said for a long time, and colleagues of mine that worked, on the campaign in 2016 and 2020, and then also in the administration, have said, you know, he was the most underserved president because a lot of people came in with their own agenda, or there were people around them that then made it very difficult for people who actually wanted to serve the agenda to get it done. And this is why personnel absolutely matters. And we're seeing, you know, some of those very encouraging appointments. I agree with you, you know, Tom Homan, that's probably my favorite pick so far. I think that's going to be very good for America. But then you have some of, you know, the more, I would say, questionable picks to say, okay, is this just a matter of loyalty, or is it a matter of actual competency and effectiveness? Like, for example, Kristi Noem now is, who's going to be the head of DHS, who doesn't really have much experience, you know, in that capacity. And so will people under her undermine her and not allow for, you know, that job to be done? So I think there is a balance, at least, between, you know, people who are loyal to the agenda, but actually also can fill the role and get it done. And I think for Bobby Kennedy, of course, you know, that's going to be something that that I hope that he knows all of the right places to go and the positions that they need to fill under these agencies to accomplish some things. So in practical terms, though, I mean, when we contrast, you know, what America's food policy looks like, for example, you know, just from agriculture to the FDA to, you know, all of this, and we contrast that to some of these places in Europe that are just so much more healthy because they don't rely on, you know, seed oils. I mean, all of these things that you talk about prolifically, Raw Egg Nationalist. Is it possible in 4 years to make substantial changes to, just in this one way, make America look a little bit more like Europe?
Yes, I mean, I don't think that the problem of ill health in America will be solved in 4 years. I absolutely do not think that. The problems, we're talking about problems that have developed over decades, maybe seven decades, let's say 70 years, I think, certainly since the end of the Second World War. So it's a deeply entrenched problem, but there are things that can be done. So one of the fundamental problems, one of the things that makes the food system very different in the EU, is the regulation of additives and novel ingredients. There are 2,000 novel additives and ingredients that are licensed for use in the EU. By comparison, in the US, nobody actually knows how many food additives are licensed as safe for use because of this insane system called generally recognized as safe that was brought in by the EPA, by the FDA, sorry, in, I think, 1958 with the Food Additives Acts. And it basically has mutated. It was originally intended actually just to allow the grandfathering of food additives onto the kind of list of food additives that were already in circulation, onto a list of safe additives, and then the regulation of further novel additives. But what happened is that it became this, because the FDA is so kind of understaffed and overworked, it became this insane system where actually companies can create their own additives, say that they're safe, and then put them in food. And the FDA has no say over that. Now, it's estimated that there are maybe 10,000 food additives in use in the US. Nobody really knows, as I say, but let's say five times the number in the US. Well, if you fundamentally reformed the system, if you made it like the EU system, if you gave the FDA more staff and more money and said, look, we're going to test all of these additives, all you companies that have created novel additives, you're going to tell us what those additives are. You're going to provide us with the safety data. We're going to test them. And if they're not safe, you know, you're not going to use them. You could actually implement an agenda like that over 4 years and transform the kind of ingredients that are used in American food, American processed food, and that would absolutely have a beneficial effect. So yes, I think 4 years is going to be, you could have a very good crack at it, and you could certainly create the beginnings of a genuine food revolution and a health revolution in the US.
And then maybe, you know, with that, as people see that, wow, we're actually healthier and this is going in the right direction, then, you know, hopefully, and, you know, we're only a week past this election, but everybody's already talking about 2028. So why not? And say, you know, for 2028, then whoever is elected there, or the Republican nominee, certainly would have to say, you know, let's move this forward. And even the left, I mean, this is something that I see out of a number of issues, you know, just like election integrity. I mean, having health in America should not be a partisan issue. And especially for somebody like RFK Jr., who, you know, has, yeah, you know, he's now an independent, basically. But that should not be something that, in terms of that policy moving forward, be so dependent on party. I mean, and that's where I think you get into kind of these factions and how much influence a lot of the lobby and big pharma and all of this really has with both parties, unfortunately. But this is something that I see as something that should not be partisan, especially if we get a really solid start for 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I have long puzzled over the question of why health and fitness have become a right-wing issue. You know, I puzzled over the reaction to The End of Men, the Tucker Carlson documentary that I was in about America's, with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., actually, about the American health crisis, the reproductive crisis, crisis of masculinity, declining testosterone levels. You know, none of this actually should be a partisan issue. And one of the strengths of that documentary actually was to play archival footage of John F. Kennedy in the 60s saying, look, there is a problem with the health of Americans and we need to do something about it. Well, he's held up, obviously, you know, as the sort of archetypal modern Democrat president. And he's saying stuff that today is considered to be right wing. So no, it shouldn't be right. Partisan at all.
Well, and my honest opinion on this and why it's partisan is because with better health comes more freedom to actually go out and work, to be more independent, to actually exercise your God-given rights. And the left is the party of wanting everyone dependent on government. And the more that you can do that with big pharma, I mean, even going to the all of these, you know, trans kids mutilation surgery, I mean, these are then creating more people who will be dependent on healthcare and ultimately socialism. I mean, this is where the Democrats don't actually care about making society the best for individuals. They want to make it so that everyone is dependent on them and the elites in government. So we got to turn this around. But Raeg, thanks so much. We'll be right back with more. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we've been talking over the course of this hour about Donald Trump's staffing picks in his new administration and the broad America First policy agenda. But he will also have a foreign policy agenda, and that includes the need to crush bureaucrats in the deep state and specifically all of these three-letter agencies and some of these, you know, ridiculous perspectives on foreign policy. And it's actually been very interesting to me to see Trump appointing Representative Elise Stefanik to be the UN ambassador. A lot of that comes from, I think, her consistent loyalty, even though she only voted about 78% with Trump in his first administration while she was a representative, but from New York, which is, you know, a little bit more challenging. But contrasting that to some of the other Republicans that voted, you know, upwards of 90% or higher, and that even included, for example, Liz Cheney. So some interesting contrast there, and there's been some mixed reaction on social media to that appointment. But one of the great things, and this coming from the National Review, the UN has faced widespread criticism from Republicans over its critical response to Israel's war in Gaza, and some members of its humanitarian organization have been accused of taking part in Hamas's October 7 attack on Israel last year. Stefanik is expected to bring her strong pro-Israel views to the United Nations once Trump returns to the White House in January. So to talk about all of the foreign policy aspects, let's bring in Eric Prince, who is the founder of Blackwater. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Well, so your view, thanks so much for joining, on Trump's foreign policy, broadly speaking.
Look, I think he believes much stronger in a strong and deterring America. The real collapse of American credibility that happened with the pullout from Afghanistan and the ensuing the enemies smell that, and they smell the weakness, and they have been encroaching ever since, whether it's China encircling Taiwan in a massive armed rehearsal, effectively, for an invasion, to Hamas's attack in Gaza. Just imagine, you know, last month we had full-on airstrikes and missile strikes from Iran to Israel and from Israel back to Iran. None of that happened under a Trump administration. So I think he has to undo the very real perceived weakness that our enemies smell of America.
I could not agree more with that. And, you know, we do have this transition time period where we have the lamest of lame ducks, Joe Biden, still in the White House, I think. I mean, he might be on a beach somewhere probably, but or not being able to walk in the sand like we saw yesterday. So this provides, though, a window potentially of opportunity before Donald Trump retakes the White House. Is there any concern of where we're at in terms of not only the conflict in the Middle East, but also the Ukraine war? I mean, you know, some of these things just in this transition period?
Well, you're entering a period in the Ukraine war where Ukraine is not able to even generate enough force to replace the casualties they're taking every day. So they need to bring that war to a close. So basically, Trump inherits an absolute disaster there, and he needs to get that one to a ceasefire, freeze the lines, and try to make some kind of lemonade out of a whole bunch of lemons.
Yeah, absolutely.
And on top of that, you're entering the very cold period, which is also a time for maneuver in the flat, muddy places like Ukraine. Anybody that's in the Midwest knows exactly what a field is like before or after winter. It's extremely muddy. It's at least now entering a hard freeze period where you can run tanks across the ground. So it's a period of even greater danger for a breakout by the Russian army.
Well, and as Trump continues to staff up his administration, I mean, are there any other signals and messages that he should be sending to some of these other world leaders at this time to basically say, you know, stand down and you don't have this transition period, you know, otherwise, as soon as I get in, you'll face consequences?
Well, I can't contrast his pick in Mike Waltz versus Jake Sullivan anymore. Jake Sullivan has never done anything dangerous in his life. And so coming from literally from the swamp as a Senate staffer, and then to be, you know, a strap hanger around Joe Biden, and that inability to understand how to send people into a difficult situation, and to weigh the risks and to make things happen versus Mike Waltz, who's a decorated SF Special Forces Green Beret officer, led in combat, loved by his men. And that is a spectacular choice for National Security Advisor. I'm really happy the president did that.
That's great. And I am very encouraged by a lot of these picks, even initially. I mean, we are just a week from the election, and already we're seeing a lot of really good personnel staffing picks. And I think it does speak to what a lot of the Trump campaign for 2024 was saying, you know, leading up to the election, is that, you know, this is going to be different this time around than, you know, some of these other more, you know, rhinos or swamp creatures, whatever you want to call them, that he ended up not being so pleased with in the first administration. So shifting gears a little bit, Eric Prince, my special guest this morning, there's also been some chatter on social media and other things very concerned about Trump's safety over the next transition period, you know, with the several assassination attempts and really the lack of attention right now, at least to the Secret Service. What are you seeing in terms of just ensuring that we do actually have a successful transition?
Well, look, what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania was obviously inexcusable and ridiculous and embarrassment for America. But at that point, the Secret Service was treating Trump not even as they were treating him only as a presidential candidate and as a former. And so and that day even had three times as many agents assigned to Jill Biden as they had to Donald Trump. Now, since he is not just a candidate after the convention, but now even the president-elect, they give him the equivalent protection as the president of the United States. And so the bubble has significantly enlarged and hardened. And so they've certainly added a lot more people and their very best people to do this job. My only concern is I hope they're addressing all the variations of modern threats, to including drone warfare, et cetera, because it's warfare and weaponry has advanced. The Ukraine war has been a real teaching lab in advanced weapons development, much of which is proliferated around the world. So we have to be aware of that.
That's really interesting. So why that specifically do you isolate as, you know, one of the things that maybe the Secret Service hasn't been prepared for?
Well, because the U.S. military isn't prepared for it. That's how much the Ukraine war has advanced the practice of warfare, effectively the democratization of precision strikes. So now something you can carry on your back and you can smack a target, you know, 10, 20 miles away. It's really frightening.
Wow. Well, hopefully we will get some with the GOP trifecta overall. We'll get a little bit more advancement into this. But, you know, this is why, for so many reasons, you know, there are issues on why I don't think that Congress historically has been doing a lot of their job in a lot of this, including giving the military what they need. But Trump is very pro U.S. military. I mean, I remember just in conversations with him how just excited
Let me stop you there. The answer is not to spend more.
Okay.
That is not the answer. We already spend way too much. We're like obese triathlete.
Well, we do spend way too much,
we need to actually get
things accomplished with it. So, I mean, so even just in terms of just giving the military though what they need isn't just in terms of spending, but in terms of actually the personnel and, you know, some of these people that that really can implement those things. And I hope that with some of his picks, you know, that will be something that is carried forward. But, you know, but I agree with you overall in terms of spending. So what actually then, you know, in your view needs to happen in terms of the military actually modernizing and being able to address these things?
People is policy, and yeah, there needs to be a significant culling of senior officers, because we just have so much overhead, and it's a very blocked, occluded decision process, and everything becomes a committee. It's basically between the Secretary of Defense and the junior man in a combat unit. There's 30 layers of decision making. That's just ridiculous. That's beyond ridiculous.
Yeah, committees never got anything done. And I learned that in higher education when I was a professor, that it's like it takes, you know, a committee 2 years to just do anything and pass anything, and they can't move it at anything in the speed of relevance. But in terms of then just the military structure, what can Trump do in terms of some of these higher level appointees? I mean, we know that the Joint Chiefs did not really serve him well, and I would say underserved him in a lot of what he wanted to do in his first administration.
He can fire a lot of generals, and he can approve any of the promotions. He can early retire a lot of them. Look, again, people is policy. And so he has the ability to affect what civilians go into those posts, from the SecDef down to all the department secretaries to significant staffing decisions that he can make. And on top of that, he can weed out the flag officer ranks and really just start to cut down the overhead and the staffs. It's time. We have as many flag officers today as we did during World War II. And in World War II, we had 14 million men under arms. Now you have 1.3 million. So the same amount of overhead, but only 10% of the troops. That's completely unbalanced. So it's time for a significant haircutting of military bureaucratic leadership.
Well said, absolutely. And there is so much in every layer of bureaucracy, whether it's the military, whether it's, you know, these other three-letter agencies, even just as we've been talking through this whole program. I mean, even the Department of Education, where Trump is saying that he wants to shut that down. I'm very much in favor for that. He ran on that in 2016. I mean, a lot of these federal agencies not only have so much bloat and so much corruption, but a lot of them aren't even constitutional. They don't actually fulfill mandates that are given to the federal government, and we have ceded so much of state authority to the federal government because the American people aren't really overall generally educated otherwise. And so I'm hopeful in a new Trump term that he'll make even more significant progress on a lot of these things than he did in his first term. Do you think, Eric Prince, that with some of these appointments, I mean, you mentioned Mike Waltz, we've been talking about Tom Homan, you know, some of these that are really good choices. Do you see that he is making smarter decisions with this knowledge and what he's learned over the first term going into his second?
So far so good. And, you know, he really did learn that last time in 2016 administration, he never really controlled his national security apparatus. I think with Mike Waltz as NSA, he is in a much better shape for that to start.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks so much, Eric Prince. Really appreciate your thoughts on all of this. And I want to remind listeners as well that we are also participating in the National Collection Week for Operation Christmas Child. You can go to the website SamaritansPurse.org/OCC to learn more and to find a drop-off location near you for all of these shoeboxes. And you can pack your shoebox with any standard size shoebox, drop it off during this year. And we have all of those drop boxes and locations and all of the information on what is best to pack in these shoeboxes and give the gift of letting a child around the world know that you care, and that more importantly, the truth of the gospel of Christ, and that Jesus loves them. And so this is a wonderful opportunity as we come up to the Christmas season to make sure that we are participating in this opportunity. So go to SamaritansPurse.org/OCC to learn more, and we will be back tomorrow with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.